Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Laura Hansen, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Western New England University. Dr. Hansen has intensively studied the origins of white-collar corporate crime, as well as means to detect and prevent malfeasance in financial institutions. Receiving her B.S., M.A., and Ph.D. in sociology from the University of California, Riverside, Laura Hansen has researched and published in the area of white-collar crime for a number of years after a previous career track in banking, taxes, and personal financing. She knows what she's talking about. In recent years, she has turned her attention to youth gang recruitment, applying what she has learned about white-collar criminal social networks. Welcome, Professor Laura Hansen.
Thank you.
So, Laura, tell us a little bit about yourself first. I always like to get started that way. Where were you born? What were your parents like?
Well, born and raised in Southern California to parents who were exceedingly adventurous. They met in Philadelphia and took a motorcycle and sidecar from Philadelphia to California and settled. So there was no way it was going to be an ordinary childhood. My mom was an artist, an amateur artist. My father was a mechanical engineer. So, you know, go figure that I go in this direction.
What is it about prisons, which are a hot topic today? We saw a major escape in New York State. And that has reflected badly on the prison industry, the people who bring dope into prisons and sell it, or who have sex with inmates, or how terrifying those experiences can be. And I'm sort of wondering, how can one on the outside possibly identify with what's going on the inside?
How can people identify with it?
In other words,
criminologists?
No, as anybody.
Well, I think unfortunately most of what education people receive as far as what life is within prison walls, they're receiving from the media, which is filtered. And those of us who've, you know, actually worked with law enforcement, worked with correction officers, have been in the prisons, you know, we realize that the story is bigger than that. And this is part of the reason why I became interested in the prevention component, for the fact that we're spending so much money and so much energy on the back end that, you know, the focus really needs to be on the front end of things in prevention.
So when you say back and front end, could you sort of help us out with what you mean by that?
Sure. What we're talking about is that, you know, a lot of people think that people get their start in crime when they're teenagers or maybe a little bit older than a teen. But the reality is that the seeds are already being planted in a number of different social ills that if we spent more time and energy on the front end of things like after school programs, funding for resource officers in schools, just general parent education, that we might possibly create a situation where they're not going to be as interested, even under the circumstances of extreme poverty, they're not going to be as interested in following a life of crime, which will ultimately end up in the criminal justice system, which will ultimately end, you know, for some, not all, but in the criminal justice system, which, you know, for many will end up in incarceration. I think what really continues to horrify me is that state after state spending so much more on corrections than what they're spending on education, on public education. And if there was more spent on the front end of community resources, then in my estimation, we might prevent a lot of the back end expense.
Well, I have no doubt that you're right. Sociologists tend to take a comprehensive view of the way all of this works. And yet, you know, we have guys like Donald Trump running for president of the United States, scaring the hell out of people about, quote, Mexican immigrants and,
right,
and the rest of it. And a good deal of the population, he happens to be the leading Republican candidate, according to the polls right now. So
right,
the sort of sociological analysis about front end, back end, you know, we have to make it fairer for people, which I certainly believe in, and in order to keep them out of prison, because there are statistics, right? I mean, we have statistics about everything, including preschool. Kids who go to preschool are much less likely to go to prison, believe it or not.
Right, right.
And so what is it about the American psyche that won't accept that?
Well, I for most of us, and, you know, maybe I'm speaking of the 99%, and most people are seriously working at their own lives, whether it's, you know, keeping a job or, you know, putting food on the table, keeping a car on the road, keeping a roof over the head. That with scrambling so much for the basics, I think that so few people have the time to really look at these issues beyond what they see on the surface, what they see in media, what they might see on Twitter or even amongst their friends on Facebook. It's just, you know, it's true about so many subjects, not just, you know, criminology, but medicine and politics and religion and everything. I think that most people are just scrambling so hard for their own little fiefdom that they just really haven't done the homework to understand all sides of the issue.
So can it ever be resolved? I mean, look, the tabloids in New York City now are filled with this guy. He pees on the sidewalk. In fact, they put him on the front page of the New York POST, peeing on the sidewalk, unbelievably, creating a new journalistic boundary for some. And people pay a lot more attention to that than they do to the politics of Boston or the politics of Albany, because they don't know. And
right.
they don't want to sort of be bothered with all of that. So they take this guy, they arrest him, Laura, and they bring him to psychiatric facilities who say, okay, we're not going to incarcerate him. He goes on the street, and a half an hour later, he gets arrested again for doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
Along come the social liberals in New York, Bill de Blasio and crowd, Mark Vitero, the speaker of the city council, and they announce that basically these should be downgraded in terms of crimes, they should be decriminalized. And yet, if somebody's going to continue to break the law, should you put them in a jail cell?
That's a real tough question.
Well, that's why I asked.
Yeah, it's a really tough question because, you know, I don't know all the pieces of this particular case, but when we're talking about something that might be psychiatric, an awful lot of criminals are just plain old, quote-unquote, normal, that they fall within the normal ranges as far as psychological makeup. But when you talk about somebody like that, if it truly is, whether it's substance abuse or whether it's a psychological or psychiatric disorder, it doesn't serve them to incarcerate them. And I'll give you an example. Several years ago, I was at a conference in San Francisco. And having been born and raised in California, I spent a lot of time in San Francisco through the years on vacations and, you know, conferences and stuff. But this one particular trip, I noticed that there weren't as many social services. It just felt like there just wasn't as much care for the homeless on the street. There was just so much more presence, and I don't think it was a function of the economy, because I believe it was 2007 when I saw this. So, you know, I, being a sociologist, started asking around and found out that, indeed, they had been starting to cut funding to social services. So there was this great presence, and so I was finishing up my conference, about ready to catch a flight back here to Boston, and I was crossing the street, and a gentleman crossing the way just decked me. I mean, just hauled off and decked me. You know, I fell to the ground and absolutely, you know, decked by this gentleman who was crossing the street. And, you know, I was a good Bostonian. I was, you know, crossing against a red light. Nobody else was, but no cars were coming. And we were the only two people in the sidewalk, and he decked me. And being that this happened right in front of this conference venue of sociologists, there were a number of people who descended on the scene, and I like to say that there were a third of them who, you know, ran off to get aid. They, you know, got ice for me. They were making sure I was okay. There was another third that was running down the street trying to go after the perpetrator, and then the other third were beginning to take field notes. And, you know, of course I'm being facetious. And even for myself, I fell in that third category. I was thinking about, okay, where am I at? What is the jurisdiction? What are they going to do? They did catch the guy. People were able to flag down the police. And so when the police asked me what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to press charges, my first question was, well, if you arrest them, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we'll take them down, we'll book them, and he'll probably be released, you know, whenever he comes down from whatever's happening. And I said, well, there's got to be other options. And I said, can he be taken to the hospital for observation? And, you know, I don't know if they did follow through on this, but that was the option that I requested was, you know, don't arrest the guy. You know, if he was off meds, get him on meds, even if it's temporary. treating him was not going to be the answer. He was clearly somebody who was either off meds or disturbed. So, yeah, so, you know, I've personally had that experience of thinking, you know, what is the best solution? And certainly mass incarceration is not the answer.
No, but on the other hand, let me try the counter-argument, which is he decked you. He could have killed you. And, you know, very nice, you're a sociologist. You may be to the left of center. You have an expansive social view of things. I'm just trying to provoke you here.
And you won't be able to.
Yeah, right. And so, very nice, you said take him to a hospital, you know, clean him up, and put him back out on the street, in which case he's going to deck somebody else crossing the street when he's not on his meds. So, therefore, if he's in a jail cell, he's not decking somebody else.
Well, but he wasn't going to be in a jail cell for much longer than if he was hospitalized. At the very least, there was more chance of his getting the medication he needed, even if it was a temporary fix. And as we all of us in this business know that there's certain disorders that people prefer not to be on the medication. They don't
right.
like how they feel on it. So I understand that. But I just felt like it was, you know, one, the more humane choice, but I also felt like it was for the greater good, because I believe that if they truly got a good, solid diagnosis and got him on meds, that at least for perhaps a longer period of time, he might not reoffend, as opposed to just incarcerating him and then putting him out on the street.
Now, Dr. Laura Hansen, you can't believe for a single second that this guy hasn't been worked up before he decked you. I mean, the guy who peed on the streets in New York had been in and out of, you know, mental institutions of one kind or another, or mental health programs, if you want to put it in a more, you know, benign way. And he was always released, and he was just doing it again. Well, okay, but someday, you know, that guy's going to pee on somebody who walks by them. And who knows what diseases he has. You know, those are my concerns. I mean, I understand where you were coming from. You did what you thought were the more humane things. But what if the guy had, for example, some contagious disease?
Well, it's a far cry talking about somebody who pees on a street and somebody who assaults somebody. And, you know,
what if they pee on you? My wife was walking through the subway station in Grand Central. She walks over and she feels something wet on her leg. There's a guy peeing on her leg. Now, that's a terrible story. If this guy has a transmissible disease or something terrible, you know, in a prison, if a guy, for example, with one of those diseases takes his feces and throws it at a jail guard, that can get you and keep you in jail for a long, long time because it's potentially lethal.
Talking about somebody peeing on somebody else, or even what happened to me, you're talking about simple assault. You're not talking about a felony offense. And so they're not going to spend much time. And then you start going the slippery slope of, well, do you want to start having a three strikes law for misdemeanors?
Yeah. Well, look, Laura, let's face it. Had he aimed differently and decked you, he could have knocked your brains out.
But he didn't.
But he could have.
Well, it was still, you know, in the eyes of the law, it was simple assault. At the end of the day, you know, I didn't have any injuries except for, you know, to my psyche. And in the eyes of the law, it would have been simple assault. And there's far more simple assault going on than others. So they're not going to be incarcerated that long. And I still feel like there's people who still need psychiatric care over incarceration. In fact, quite a few.
Do you think anybody who commits a crime is basically psychiatrically disturbed?
No.
In other words, let's say somebody picks up a gun and murders another human being. And let's just say, for the sake of it, that the person works for the mob, does this and robs someone. Don't you think they have to be, by definition, crazy?
No. Because most criminals, no, because then we get into some really deep discussion about all the different theories of why they picked up the gun in the first place. And there are some people who would, you know, point to psychological reasons, psychological traits, but then there are a lot of people who would be pointing to the social structure. You know, and we haven't even begun to talk about white-collar crime. Is somebody crazy just because they decide to do insider trading or they decide to embezzle from the company? I mean, that's still a crime.
Well, wait. So you don't think that Bernie Madoff, who, you know, head of a major stock exchange, this and that and other,
right.
other thing, steals basically billions of dollars from his clients. You don't think on some level that guy who disturbs his whole equilibrium, his family, he didn't have to do it. He could have made a living. You don't think that guy's crazy?
That's just too broad of a stroke. I would say that maybe, well, see, I don't know him per se. I don't know enough beyond what we see on the surface or what we've read in the news to know, is this somebody who has a psychological disorder, or is it just purely a condition of business as usual on Wall Street?
We are talking with Dr. Laura Hansen, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Western New England University. Laura, fascinating discussion so far, and I really thank you for doing it with us. So let's talk a little bit more about white-collar crime.
Okay.
And I know that you have studied this stuff. You gave a speech at OLLI, an organization I truly love in the Berkshires. When good companies go bad, deviance in crime in American corporations. How do good companies go bad?
In my estimation, and that's my, you know, this is my scholarly opinion, is that an awful lot has to do with the culture of the company. It has to do with the business culture, but it also has to do with the social culture. So we have two different structures that are in play in any organization. You have the formal structure that looks very much like a bureaucratic chain of command. And then what you have, and we're talking about larger corporations. We're not talking about the smaller businesses. We're talking about the large corporations. Most of them function or have to function on a classic bureaucratic structure. And then you have the informal structure. So, for instance, one thing that the phenomena we've had with technology getting exponentially more complex is that the managers may not necessarily know the details of the work of the people they're supervising. So, for instance, somebody who has an MBA is hired to supervise a group of engineers. If that's the case, then that means that whenever there's an evaluation or somebody is coming up for review, that review may very well be ceremonial. There's been a lot of literature written about this, the idea of the ceremonial evaluation, that as long as you don't detect that something is going wrong, then everything appears to be fine. You pat the individual on the head and says, good job. Attaboy or attagirl, and off they go. Whereas there might be something malignant that's happening, whether it's a flaw in the system that is being ignored or swept under the rug.
Yeah, if the tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, you know, it didn't happen. But it does happen, you know, but it does happen.
Oh, trust me, in corporations, there's a lot of people who hear the tree fell and they just don't want to tell anybody about it.
Sure. And when you interview folks who have gotten themselves into trouble, what are you hearing from them? I mean,
I
wish I hadn't done that. It affected my family. It affected my life. You know, this kind of thing. Or are you feeling that they're just always going to avoid responsibility?
Well, you know, first of all, we have to clarify that the research I've done has not directly talked to people who have committed white-collar crimes. It has been to prosecutors or former prosecutors of these types of crimes. But the criminals themselves, you know, for good reason, are not going to be talking to somebody like me.
I don't know about that. I get a letter quite frequently from a single individual who's been incarcerated for a long time who wants me to tell his story.
But what type of crime did they commit?
It was a violent crime, I believe.
Okay. Well, we're talking about two different things. Generally, if people commit violent crimes and they're caught and they're incarcerated, when they get out, there's very few options for them as far as employment, as far as their social life. There's very, very few options. Somebody who commits a white-collar crime on the scale of, and I'm going to pick on Milken here because he's, you know, sort of a poster child. Somebody on the lines of Milken, you know, it's Michael Milken. It's like bad, bad, you did bad, naughty, naughty, bad. We're going to punish you. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm contrite, but you know what? I'm going to go on and do something else. So he's gone on and had a successful career.
Because he had some money to begin with.
Well, part of it's that, but he had a lot of social capital, too. He had his education. He had his network. And, you know, those things don't go away just because you're incarcerated. You know, Madoff's kind of a bad example, because Madoff was, first of all, it's a Ponzi scheme, which is something that's his whole company was operating under illegal means. But if you're talking about a corporation that on the most part chugging along, following most rules, you know, complying with SEC, and then you have a handful of people that within that company are doing extracurricular activity, you know, whether it's insider trading or cooking with books or whatever it is, then that's operating under a whole different operation.
You know, you make a very interesting point. I remember at one point, I think it was President Bill Clinton, who pardoned a whole bunch of, you know, insider, white-collar traders, many of whom had some real money, and sort of did it. And, you know, it appalled me, to be honest with you, that they would get away with it, but some kid who walked into a drugstore and threatened violence would go to jail for a long, long time. And so you make a very interesting distinction between, you know, violent crime and white-collar crime. And yet our legislators pass white-collar laws, don't they?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because the pendulum swings more as far as regulation and legislation on white-collar crime than it does on violent crime. So much of it is political. So much of it is, do we want big government or do we want small government? You know, from my estimation, from what I've seen, agencies that are investigating white-collar crime are grossly understaffed and, you know, grossly with few resources in order to really do a good job of it. You know, SEC, bless their heart, and if you know anything about the South, you know, when you say bless their heart,
yeah, it means something
I'm
else.
I'm saying, yes, they're just doing the best they can with what little. They're sort of like MacGyver. They're trying to function with, you know, capturing all the bad guys or women. I shouldn't be sexist about this, but people on Wall Street with, you know, a pack of chewing gum. So in all fairness, people who are going after these types of criminals are grossly understaffed. I mean, my gosh, you know, when it comes to violent crime or crime in general, we're grossly understaffed with the necessary personnel to get it all.
Now, let me ask you a question. Your previous career obviously made you somewhat interested, right, in white-collar crime. What did you do? What did you do, and what was the motivation for getting serious about studying this?
Well, long story short, I started out in banking, in mortgage banking, and went to a commercial bank for a while. And then ultimately, when I went, I had children, and then when I went back into the workforce, I started out as a certified tax preparer, and I was wooed away, and I'm not going to, you know, name companies because I'm, you know, going to divulge some information here, but I was wooed away to help out behind the scenes as a financial peer planner with a financial planner. And when I was doing taxes, and I do about 400 returns a year, when I was doing taxes, I found that even though these were numbers on paper, they were social stories. And that so many people who came in, whether it was with investments or without investments, they didn't seem to know what the heck to do with their money. And I became very interested in the whole concept of financial planning. So, of course, you have to learn something about stocks, and you have to learn a little bit about investments, even as a financial peer planner, where you're really a bit of a data cruncher and data collector. So behind the scenes, again, was, you know, working with this financial planner, I was able to kind of deconstruct these social stories of what these people's financial situations were. And I still was sort of feeling like, well, the service of a financial planner is to make sure that they're doing the best they can to assure in the long term that they're going to be cared for, in particular in retirement. So, and, you know, keeping in mind that this is in the 1990s, this is in an era where pensions were becoming, you know, scarcer and scarcer, and you know, waving the flag of annuities and 401ks and all the other vehicles for retirement. So, you know, just like any profession, you go in, you know, sort of dewy-eyed, this is what I'm going to do, and then you find out, oh, the real job is to sell these products. And I didn't care for that scheme at all. I felt like some of the situations I saw were sort of a disservice to clients. And there was, and I won't go in detail, but there was an incident that I just felt like it was legal what was being done, but I just didn't like what it smelled like. And I put in my my notice, and I ran back to academics and fast tracked through to finish up my PhD. But I always intended. When I got into graduate school, I always intended to focus on large-scale organizations and the things that go wrong in them. But in the course of doing that, I took that usual left turn that a lot of us taken, I don't mean left on the political spectrum, took that turn, that, you know, Robert Frost moment of taking a path least chosen, and I realized that what I had in knowledge from my previous career could be segued into studying white-collar corporate crime, and in particular, insider trading. So that's where my interest came from. It was, you know, from being out in the work world, starting to think about what makes an individual commit a financial crime when they're being well compensated, or at least well compensated as far as we're concerned, you know, as average Joes and Josettes, Josies, being well compensated, and yet they still make the choice to commit a white-collar crime, or even malfeasance. Something that's sort of in that gray area. Is it really crime? Is it not? You know, as long as everybody else is doing it, you know, maybe legislation is wrong or maybe regulation is wrong, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so if you get something like insider trading, that's, you know, people trade on the stock market by the millions every day.
Right.
And everybody thinks they've heard something or that they know somebody. Something. And every once in a while, somebody puts a shotgun in the barrel and somebody gets hurt. In other words, somebody gets picked up for this insider trading. So it's almost almost impossible to do enforcement well.
Right.
And fairly.
Right. And the difficulty is the trades are so fast. The paper trail is getting shorter and shorter and shorter as far as from a temporal quality. So it's interesting. And I don't know how true this is, but I read some time ago that if you look at the portfolios of people who are in Congress, that whenever there's a huge announcement on something, that there's an uptick. There's an uptick of activity. Now, I don't know how true that is.
Uptick in the stock market, you mean?
An uptick of activity. Now, an uptick doesn't necessarily mean that there's just activity, because there's, you know, the three options, you buy, sell, or hold. And there's just that uptick of activity just prior to announcement. And I don't know how accurate this is, and I certainly, you know, don't want to say that everybody in Congress is committing insider trading. But I suspect that because it's such a gray area of at what point is it really insider trading? At what point is it that you made a shrewd business decision moments before the announcement? So it's a real difficult crime to detect, and it's a really difficult crime to prosecute.
So when the federal U.S. attorneys find somebody who is in violation of a Securities and Exchange rule or law, do they treat them with some sense of justice? In other words, is everybody the same, or do the people who have the most get the easiest ride?
Well, you know, we like to say in this business, you know, we're running on a premise of innocent until proven guilty. And in a lot of our estimations, it's that you're guilty until proven affluent. So the reality is that except in exceptional cases, you know, where somebody's made a poster child or they're made an example of...
The Michael Milkins you addressed before is a good example.
And there's been, you know, you look at Keating, if you look at even Martha Stewart to some extent, even though, you know, she was never convicted of insider trading. Just, you know, point of finger, shaming, it's sort of like putting a placard on them, putting them out in public and saying, I did a bad thing. But the reality is that, on the most part, an awful lot of corporate crime is not, or what we would consider to be crime, is treated as a civil offense rather than a criminal offense. And there's good reason for it. Would you really, if you found a corporation, and we're not talking about on the scale of Enron, if we had a company that was doing everything right, and you had a handful of people who made bad business decisions for whatever reasons, whether it was greed or fear, whatever the reason, they made some bad business decisions that could hurt the company. Would you, for the sake of stockholders or just, you know, for social fabric in general, would you want to take that whole company down? No. I think that if the corporation itself, it's perfectly acceptable to give them a civil fine. But a lot of times they protect the people within the company because they don't want that ugly publicity. I mean, that's just my opinion. They just don't want the publicity. So, You know, fire the person, make an example of them, you know, drive them out of town, but don't go through some long, laborious criminal trial that might end up adding some taint to the company itself.
So, look, you've been an expert, obviously, in white-collar crime.
Oh, we don't like to call ourselves experts. I'm a specialist.
Well,
so I've
you have a Ph.D.
Specialist.
Yeah. So, okay. So, anyway, Laura, just kidding. You now move to street gangs. Now, that was an interesting transition from gangs in Wall Street firms to street gangs. What made you do that?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, making the move from Boston to Western New England to Western Massachusetts. You know, being that, you know, our beautiful campus, our beautiful college is just down the road, but still quite a ways, but enough down the road in our own backyard where there are things to study here as far as more ordinary crime, including, you know, I'm less likely to find somebody committing white-collar crime out here than I'm to find somebody who's in a gang. So part of it was the convenience of my social lab, my immediate social lab, but the other thing was that I started looking at, as we discussed at the beginning of this interview, talking about the cost of incarceration. And not that I want to put a whole bunch of correction officers out of work, but the reality is that, you know, you can see the conditions of certain schools. You can see the schools that are at risk. You see the neighborhoods that are at risk. You see the families that are at risk. And the more I looked at the dynamics of gangs and even the recruitment techniques, I thought, this isn't that far off from white-collar crime conspiracies from a social network standpoint. You're still talking about people that are feeling there's a deficiency in their immediate circle. They have to find something else to fill that gap. And, you know, for good or bad, they latch on to a group of people that happen to be committing crimes.
So how's it gone? How do you do it? Do you find some gang members and talk to them, or how do you do that?
No. If you ever saw me in person, you know, I'm a white middle class woman. You know, I can't do one of these ethnographies where I can be a gang leader for the day. So I worked until very recently. I've worked with South Holyoke Safe Neighborhoods Initiative. I've worked amongst people who are in the social agencies. Yes, there are people who are former gang members that I've had an opportunity to speak with. But I've also talked to educators, to teachers, to elementary school teachers and administrators about the risk of recruitment in elementary. So I can't do anything about white-collar crime. I mean, that was a reality. I learned very early on in my career that very few people are going to give me funding to study white-collar crime, and I sure as heck can't go riding up on the streets of New York and trying to clean up Wall Street. But a small measure from an applied standpoint, there were things I could do to educate people who are working directly with these populations. So it's been very, very rewarding. I can't say enough about South Holyoke Safe Neighborhoods Initiative. They've done really amazing things on a shoestring. And, you know, I've really enjoyed the work with them, and I really think that they're doing good things. And it's really been grassroots.
Yeah, but in terms of your scholarship, in terms of your academic approach, I'm always brought back in these discussions to Officer Krupke in West Side Story. You know, and the kids are kidding him and saying, you know, you've got a social disease as opposed to that you're kidding people over the head. And you're going and you're talking to the social workers and you're talking to the, you know, to the teachers and you're talking, but you're not talking to them. And to some degree, that has to count, it seems to me, because even if they're not terribly articulate, they can pretty well tell you why they do what they do and what their social networks are and why they form certain gangs and why they go into the Crips or the Bloods.
I will tell you that, you know, my handicap, so to speak, is the fact that I am not somebody physically or culturally that can just walk into one of those neighborhoods and embed myself and expect them to spill their guts. I think that I look too much like the establishment. And so I rely very heavily on the scholarship of other people that have come before me and have done these types of ethnographies. And keeping in mind that those are very, very subjective, too. So, you know, we're not working blindly here. We do have a lot of scholarship that came before us that we can study. But from my standpoint, I'm really on the prevention end of things. And so for me, I get more bang for my buck if I'm in the trenches with the people that are working directly with this population, whether it's parents or I've spoken with parents, whether it's parents, educators, or people who are working in the social agencies or social work agencies.
It has been said that a 14-year-old firing a gun can kill you just as badly as an adult doing that. Mm-hmm. How serious is this situation that you've been studying?
I think it's serious enough that we have to come to the realization that gang recruitment prevention or gang violence prevention doesn't begin in junior high. A lot of the programs that you see in public schools start at around the junior high age. We really need to start much younger than that. And you cannot go in with the approach of saying gangs are bad. You cannot go in with that approach because a lot of these children are in families that are gang affiliated, whether it's parents or siblings or, you know, grandparent or whatever. You know, when you're talking about Crips and Bloods, you're talking about, you know, multi-generational now. It's just like, don't do drugs. You can't go in and say gangs are bad. You have to kind of show them the consequences and let them come to their own conclusion that it's bad and then give them alternatives.
Even when you say that, you can't say that it's bad, but you can come in there and you can show them the consequences of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm coming from. That says the gangs are bad.
But it's a much gentler way than saying that people who are in gangs are bad people. You see what I'm getting at? In other words, if you go in and you tell a bunch of children in the inner city, whether you're talking about Philadelphia or New York or Los Angeles or, you know, San Diego, any of the cities that are really plagued with social ills and as a consequence gangs, you can't go into and particularly at elementary age, you can't go in and say gangs are bad. Even at junior high, you can't say gangs are bad. Because, you know, in their minds, it'll be like, oh, well, so you're telling me my brother's bad or my father's or my mother's bad. It's better to educate them to the consequences because, you know, maybe they're seeing some of the consequences in their community. They're not completely blind to it, but they may be also seeing some of the benefits of gang membership from a financial and social standpoint.
So when you compare organized crime to street gangs, which I know you have done in the past, what are you finding the similarities that we ought to know about?
Well, there are different types of street gangs. An awful lot of street gangs are nothing more than little neighborhood cliques that, by definition, because their activities are defined by law enforcement as being gangs. Many of those are short-lived. Many of those, because of either transient population or a number of other factors that get co-opted into bigger gangs, those fizzle and die. They're the ones that come up with the cute little names for themselves, some of which we should take seriously, but they come up with a, you know, cute little name for themselves, you know, a few gang signs, and maybe, you know, clothing attire that might associate them or make them feel associated with this particular clique. Those tend to be short-lived. They have a lifespan of approximately 18 months. However, as far as the larger gangs, there's no difference between that and organized crime. It is organized crime. They have very sophisticated networks. They have very profound.
What kind of criminal? And what is in that underground economy? And what is the criminal activity that they're doing?
Oh gosh, what isn't there? It depends on the gang, but you know the most common thing is drugs, weapons. It can be prostitution. It can be human trafficking. But they're getting a lot more tech savvy. That's the other thing, is that they're becoming a lot more technically savvy. So I've been kind of interested. I've been talking to a colleague about the phenomena of smuggling, which, you know, when you look at a Mexican cartel, when you look at that type of phenomena, which has been of interest to me, how big of a leap is it to go from what we see as far as the standard fare of drugs, prostitution, arms, weapons, things like that, to high tech? And so I'm curious about that as there becomes, for instance, with the legalization of marijuana in certain states, we know that that's certainly putting the kibosh on a little bit of the trade, not all of it, but a little bit of the trade. So, you know, if one market dries up, you think, well, where's the next next market.
So you mentioned the word prostitution. I find that very interesting because I know that you're a feminist, as other professors and others are, and in the truest sense of the word.
There's a big assumption. I'll own it, but there are feminists and there are feminists. So
okay, that's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah. Long scale. But you mentioned the word prostitution, and I'm fascinated by that in terms of gangs and the recruitment of young women into gangs and getting this treatment. What have you learned about their reception to being utilized in this way?
Well, you have to realize that they're coming from, most of them, not all, but most of them are coming from pretty dire social circumstances. Many of them have been victims of sexual abuse, and they see a gang as being the pseudo-family, to be the family that they don't have. And so women in general, whether they're being used as prostitutes or whether they're just being used as sex objects in general within the context of gangs, and again, it's different from gang to gang. We have some gangs that claim to be more egalitarian, like the Almighty Lan King and Queen Nation. Equally have men and women, and at least they give lip service to a certain amount of equality. But on the most part, women as being on in the peripheral of a male-dominated gang, they're coming from circumstances that are pretty grim. And the thing is we have prostitutes and we have prostitutes. A number of women who enter into the profession are drug addicted. And if they're drug addicted, you know, what is their means by which to obtain the drug? And if you have no other skill set, you know, except for your body, then, you know, ergo, that's an option. So we can't say that in all gangs women are being abused, but for many, in many gangs, they're being abused, whether it's through prostitution or sexual exploitation.
Huh. So you started by telling us that prisons on the front end and the rear end were determined by the social environment that everybody grows up in. I don't think there's any question about that now. That doesn't mean there aren't some rich people who go to jail.
Right.
It does mean, for the most part, if your mother was a single mom with a heroin addiction, that meant that your chances of doing really badly in life were pretty
good. I'll go one further on that statement. The woman doesn't even have to be heroin addicted. A child of a single teen parent, female, is much more likely to end up incarcerated. So they don't even have to be drug addicted.
No, but if the mom is drug addicted, it's
certainly that exponentially adds to the issues and problems.
Certainly can't help.
Right.
So the question now becomes, what is the likelihood we can solve this stuff? Or is it just forever going to happen?
That prevention is the Achilles heel, and I'm, you know, I'm quoting somebody else. I can't take credit for that, but I had read that prevention is the Achilles heel, and it can't be a one-size-fits-all. That's one thing I've learned in my work, is that what works for one community is not going to necessarily work for another community, and yet that's what we've continued to do as far as policy to prevent crime. One size doesn't fit all. Communities have their own distinct cultures, and I'm not just talking from ethnicity or race. I'm talking about just culture in general. And so,
so give us an example, if you will, Laura, of two cities with different cultures. What are some of those differences between the cultures of a Springfield and another city, Holyoke?
Oh gosh. Well, okay. I will give you an example that I gave to my students last year. I taught a class that was comparing Reykjavik, Iceland, with Springfield. And if you look at the two cities, you'd think, oh, they're completely different. They're completely different, different demographic, and yet there are a lot of the same social dynamics. You have an influx of immigrants in Reykjavik, not a big influx, but enough that certainly in a population of approximately 250,000, it's a noticeable change. They were hit with an economic downturn. We were hit with an economic downturn, meaning less opportunity for young people. They were increasingly having problems with drugs, and we increasingly had problems with drugs. So there's a lot of similarities. Where we differ is that Springfield pretty much works on the same premise as a lot of major cities. It's extraction. It's going in, extracting the people that you think are causing the biggest problems in hopes that that stops some of the problems. And that includes with youth violence. What they're doing different in Reykjavik, and they've done historically, is that they don't really have a juvenile justice system. It's sort of the old Hillary Clinton, it takes a village mentality, that until you're an adult and commit a crime, you are in Iceland, if you commit a crime, it's more like the community circles the wagons and tries to do what's best. Now, there are programs like that in the United States that are still very experimental, the type of thing of having identified certain young people that are either at risk or have already, you know, had brushes with the law, of having the community all work together to help that individual or group of individuals rehabilitate.
But Laura Hansen, I wanted to ask you this. There's a big difference between a Springfield with a heterogeneous population and a Reykjavik, is there not, in terms of who is accepted and who's an outsider?
Well, some of the same social dynamics are going on, though.
Really? I mean, if everybody is white, for example.
But they're not.
Okay, tell
That's
us about that.
That is the misconception. We've had populations throughout Europe, Africa, Eastern Europe.
In Reykjavik.
Russia, that have left and found places that they thought were greener pastures. And one of the places that some of these populations have looked to is Iceland. So they've had a large influx of outsiders.
Interesting.
But it's not just that. It's the fact that with the downturn of the economy, the youth in general, doesn't matter whether it's a heterogeneous or a homogeneous population, if young people can't get jobs, if they have no hope for a future, what else are they going to do?
Okay, so now comparing Springfield, just to get back to that, and Iceland, what are you finding the most dissonant places are in your study? In other words, how are they most not alike?
How are they most not alike? You mean between Iceland and...
Yes.
And here?
Yes.
Oh, well, I think that just the way they handle juvenile crime.
So,
I think that's biggest difference is how they handle juvenile crime.
And if you took the Iceland approach and tried to use it in Springfield, would it work?
In theory, it could, but I don't believe...
And if not, why not?
I think that we just have such an institutionalized criminal justice system, both juvenile and adult, that it'd be very difficult to make that shift.
Is it because we have an industry? I mean, you know, we talk about the upstate New York economy, which is highly dependent on a lot of the prisons that we have. The corrections officers, lifelong jobs and things like that. We make a dramatic change. We might not be only trying to answer how to make things better, but in other ways.
Well, we might end up with a different type of social ill because then we're talking about unemployment in a big industry. So, I think...
Well, that's why I was trying to make the comparison between Iceland...
This is sort of like the totality. It's sort of like the totality. You know, Reykjavik has done, or Iceland in general, this is the way they've done it. Could they segue to the type of system we have?
Or the other way around. Possibly. Or the other way around.
I think Pandora's box is open. I think once you create this institution the way it is now, and I mean, it's been going on for, you know, a long time, the way it's function, that, you know, Pandora's box is open, so it'd be difficult to go back to what was initially a lot of what you did in communities. If a kid was acting up, you circled the wagons and hoped that the community can bring the kid around. Didn't work with everyone, and certainly didn't work in all social demographics, but, you know, and parents have had to give up an awful lot of their ability to discipline. And I'm not saying that, you know, parents should be beating their children, but I mean, once you send them off to school, you lose a lot of ability to influence them.
Okay, we only have a couple of seconds, but I want to know,
sure,
summing up, what should we do with street gangs in Springfield?
I think we need to front end it. It goes back to the same old story that we need to front-end it in education. You know, instead of taking an at-risk school and pulling fundings, you need to put more funding into it. You need more after-school programs. You need more extracurricular activities. You need to bring music and art back in. And sadly, on the back end, I don't know that there's any solution to this. We need to create jobs for people who are not going to go into college.
Yep, I see it.
You know.
I wish I could keep talking, but we can't. We're out of time. We've been talking to Dr. Laura Hansen, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Western New England University, one of my favorite places. Professor, thanks so much.
Mine too.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.